This morning's docket is case number 57461. It is Rolf Jensen & Associates versus the District Court, Mandalay Corporation. Before we proceed, I wish to announce that Justice Pickering has voluntarily recused herself from this case. The court will proceed as a six-member court. Counsel, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Very well.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. If it may please the court, my name is Jean Weil. I represent Rolf Jensen & Associates, petitioner in this action. On behalf of my client and myself, I'd like to thank you for accepting this very important decision for review. The court had asked in a minute order that I address, or the parties address, the procedural propriety of extraordinary relief being requested in this case. I'm going to try and do it very quickly because there are quite a few cases that address it. Briefly, the cases which touch upon this issue are Child versus Lomax, Lowe Enterprises versus District Court, State Division of Child and Family Services, Gonski versus District Court, and there's also a Ninth Circuit Court entitled Valenzuela versus Gonzalez. Collectively, these courts address a number of factors, and no single factor is determinative in the court's decision to grant extraordinary relief. But of the many factors discussed, the factors that do apply to the facts of this case are as follows. While one factor is no plain, speedy, or adequate remedy at law, I think it is true that the parties could spend several months in a jury trial in the lower court and then appeal from that decision. However, that's by no means a plain remedy or a speedy remedy, and it will exhaust a great amount of judicial resources in the process. As your honors are well aware of the lower courts and their clogged calendars, a several month jury trial is extremely taxing on the court and the taxpayers and the jurors who would have to serve. It's not even easy to find juries that can serve for that length of time.
And Ms. Weil, how long do you estimate the trial in this case would take?
At least 60 days, Your Honor. It's a jury trial. There is therefore sound judicial economy at issue that would favor granting extraordinary relief. And essentially, we are here today. The matter has been briefed. And, rather than to essentially kick the can down the road another year or so, we'll be revisiting this. It makes perfect sense and in the interest of judicial economy to address the case today.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you.
Yes.
I just do this in the hopes that you and your colleague and those watching oral argument will focus not on the cases that you recited, but on the case of IGT and Williams versus Baxter, which was recently decided, which articulated for much of the opinion the factors that the court will now employ when considering writ relief in these circumstances.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the factors in IGT, but I will, if possible, reserve comment for that upon my rebuttal. I'm reserving 3 minutes see if I can address those factors. Other factors, of course, are it's a case involving statewide importance in a matter likely to replicate itself. Nevada obviously has a robust hospitality and housing industry. Maybe not so robust today, but in the past and in the future for sure. It involves an issue of law that needs clarification since the lower court was obviously unsure whether she was bound by federal Supreme Court decisions and their progeny, as well as federal statutes and the interpretation of that federal statute, the ADA. Other issues that are addressed in extraordinary relief include whether the trial court has exceeded its authority, which in this instance we believe that the lower court has, and that the district court order is erroneous as a matter of law. In short, and lastly, this is a matter of first impression before this court, and review on a petition for writ of mandamus is de novo. Okay, turning to the arguments in the petition, the Supremacy Clause of the United States is the federal law is the supreme law of the land, and judges in every state shall be bound state law notwithstanding. This certainly includes all United States Supreme Court decisions and federal statutes enacted by Congress. And while the lower court did not believe that the Niles-Bolton decision was binding upon her, surely all of the United States Supreme Court decisions that it discusses and other similar cases cited by the United States Supreme, other United States Supreme Court, in other United States Supreme Court decisions, those are binding. And the interpretation of the statute at issue, the ADA, is also binding as a federal statute upon the lower court. The Court versus Ash decision, United States Supreme Court 1975, outlined a four-pronged test in order to determine if a private implied remedy existed within the text of the statute. A number of questions. Is plaintiff a member of the class the statute was enacted to protect? Of course, in this case, Mandalay is not a member of the class the statute was enacted to protect, and the lower court, district court, so found that in relationship to its ruling on another motion for summary judgment when the court dismissed Nevada, breach by Nevada ADA. The court found that that Mandalay was not a member of the class the statute was designed to protect. Secondly, is there any indication of legislative intent, implicit or explicit, to create a private remedy? In the American with Disabilities Act, the ADA, there have been five federal courts that have examined it and all concluded uniformly that there is no explicit or implicit creation of a private remedy inclusive in that act. Thirdly, is it consistent with the underlying purposes of the legislative scheme?
Before you move to number three, I have a question about number two. It seems to me that the federal cases that you've noted, when they state there's nothing implicit or explicit in the act that bars indemnification contract remedies, I fail to see how they arrive at the conclusion then that the act prevents that. Could you comment on a law review article by Charles Daugherty where he too questions the limits on contractual risk imposed by these cases and their theory?
Your Honor, I believe that those five cases that we're referring to, and to make sure we're all on the same page, those are the U.S. versus Quality Belt, Gambone Brothers, Shanry, Bowers, and Access for All. Essentially, they analyzed the statute to determine whether there was anything implicit or explicit that granted private remedies. And there is, in one small, not a small area, but one very discrete area where the ADA permits for private rights and private remedies, and that is in the area of landlord-tenant. And it's located within Title III, and there is quite a comprehensive scheme that permits landlords and tenants in various landlord-tenant relationships to contract for ADA compliance and affords them private remedies of contribution. The mere fact that Congress saw fit to enact, it's over 50 pages of discussion in Title III about the creation of these private rights in the context, the sole context of landlord-tenant, absolutely belies any notion that, oh, well, then they must have also intended those rights to be available in a different context, let's say between an owner, an architect, or a consultant. Because surely, if Congress had intended those rights to exist, private rights to exist in other arenas and other relationships, it would have so delineated them in the statute. And the fact that they did so delineate in one specific area and elected not to in another, I believe is dispositive on the issue that those private rights were not intended.
Well, to me, it seems like a substantial leap of faith to suggest that Congress's silence be treated as abrogating all state contract indemnity and risk-shifting contracts.
Well, Your Honor, it's not simply the question of silence. Traditionally, in fields that have been occupied by federal law, such as the commerce, interstate commerce, such as federal securities, and such as discrimination in civil rights, such as the Act here, where you have federal legislation that occupies the field, and these areas of legislation are not typically or traditionally relegated to state law, then there is an inference, more than an inference, that these occupied fields were not ever intended to provide state rights, and that, you know, these statutes in general are regulatory statutes. They're not compensatory statutes. They're intended to regulate conduct of individuals who are bound by them. And therefore, state laws which conflict with those statutes must yield because they frustrate the purpose of the statute which Congress enacted.
Counsel, in that analysis, there is a major stretch in terms of it seems that the ADA provisions require the primary person, the owner, property owner, to comply with the responsibility.
I'm sorry, you know, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
As you're talking about the ADA and what they're requiring, it's like they are just, they're asking the first party, the owner, to comply.
No.
That seems to be the primary purpose of this.
Well.
And saying you don't get off the hook, you have to pay up. Well, in this case, theoretically, they've paid up, they've settled. So why has not compliance been had with
the ADA? Why has not compliance been had? Well, I think that I don't believe, first of all, that all of the retrofits have been implemented yet in this particular case. And there was compliance, but the Department of Justice and the statute compels compliance by every member, not just the owner builder. It's also true of a general contractor or an architect or an ADA consultant. I mean, compliance is mandatory under the statute for all of the individuals involved. And therefore, while I think topically one could say, gee, this doesn't seem fair that an owner can't recover indemnity or contribution from others who were responsible, you know, essentially Niles Bolton lays it out as simply and succinctly as possible, which is that would absolutely be antithetical to the framers of that
I'd like to test that again, if I may. I don't see how parties who enter into voluntary agreements to shift or share in risk by contract defeats the policy of non-delegable duties under the ADA. I don't know that Niles Bolton got it right, is my question, and that's why I asked you if you're familiar to comment about the Indiana Law Review, which seems to criticize that very point.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that particular Law Review article. However, let me respond as this. Let me give you a perfect example. Let's say there is a gray area of compliance within the ADA, and it's something that comes up very late in construction, and the owner is going to suffer a delay and extreme cost overruns if they take the conservative route and decide to implement this item of compliance. If that owner knows that they can shift all or part of the responsibility for that item, if they make the decision not to be compliant, then it is an absolute disincentive for that owner to comply. And that is exactly what the ADA has sought to avoid. It does not want to incentivize, the Act does not seek to incentivize anyone from violating its rules and regulations. And if parties can merely contract around their financial obligations for compliance by foisting the obligations onto others, such as the Niles Bolton, the architect, then it absolutely will thwart and undermine the objective of the act. It is regulatory, not compensatory. I mean, I understand the argument, hey, this isn't fair. But by definition, the ADA is not a compensatory act. It provides no private remedies. And I believe, Your Honor, the Archstone Court and the five courts leading up to it that were all the progeny of the Supreme Court decision in Northwest Airlines did, in fact, get it right. I realize it is a difficult decision to swallow, but the deeper you drill down and the deeper you understand what the congressional intent was in protecting individuals with disabilities against discrimination was to essentially maximize compliance. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gene Back is appearing on behalf of all three amici curiae. They've asked me to be their chief spokesman. They've reserved some time for themselves. We thank you for allowing us oral argument in this proceeding. HALCRO and Converse Consultants have other writs before the court as well. We are here today to ask Your Honors to plug a loophole that has been created by dicta in the Terracon decision. Since Terracon was entered by this court in 2009, there have been some inconsistencies in its application. Courts have looked at the dicta and thought that Terracon stood for the proposition that there's an exception to the economic loss doctrine with negligent misrepresentation. Other courts have looked to the language of this court embracing the public policies addressed there and in Callaway to say no, we're not going to allow unintentional torts, we're not going to allow negligent misrepresentation. So we need some clarity on those issues, and we appreciate being before you today to address them. The construction industry and the participants that are in that industry in the commercial world in large construction projects, which we are fortunate to have here in Nevada with projects like City Center and Mandalay, billion-plus-dollar projects, bring together very sophisticated players. The construction industry has been responsible for bringing to the forefront not only contractual risk allocation provisions and contracts, but dispute resolution matters that this court has addressed. Sophisticated parties come together to bargain risk allocation. Parties have different risk tolerance. Some parties are more averse to risk than others, but the price of risk can be negotiated. And it is negotiated by these parties in a variety of ways. These construction parties, whether they're a construction manager, an inspector, or like my client, a structural engineer, whether a subcontractor or other consultant like RJA, negotiate through indemnity clauses. This court has a long history of looking at written indemnity provisions that go from A to Z on what they encompass. The parties negotiate the types of indemnity that they would like. They negotiate insurance provisions. This court has looked at some of those, in additional insured endorsements, OSIP policies, various types of insurance to govern risk. There are guarantee provisions, warranty provisions. Construction contracts have a whole host of risk-shifting provisions. What then happens, and now is happening because of the dicta in Terracon, are parties that didn't negotiate the right benefit of the bargain at the negotiating table and find themselves looking for a remedy, either as a plaintiff or as a cross-claimant or as a third-party complainant, are looking to create a new duty based on tort law. This court embraced the idea in Terracon and Callaway that with sophisticated, large construction projects in the commercial context, as opposed to the residential context, contract principles should override tort law, that there should be a reasonable expectation of what risk you have entertained in this endeavor, what price you're being paid. For example, RJA have gone to Mandalay and said, we, for the fee you're paying us, are unwilling to bite the bullet and undertake this huge risk of ADA compliance. We want a limitation of liability. And they could have negotiated that. And it would be wrong, in our opinion, for this court to say, well, if they didn't do that, if they don't have an express agreement, if they haven't negotiated either through the architect or directly with the consultant for the kind of indemnity they want, assuming it's not preempted, then we shouldn't fashion a remedy under 552 of the restatement, under the Stremel decision, on a negligent misrepresentation kind of theory to come up with something the parties did not bargain for. We don't believe that the history of those cases in Nevada, negligent misrepresentation cases, really go to the heart of what we do in construction projects. Construction projects start with learning about the project delivery methodology. And it all depends on cost, time, and quality. And the parties get together based on those factors and determine whether it's going to be a fast-track project, whether it's going to be a traditional lump sum project, a GMP project, a construction manager risk project, the AIA, the AGC, many organizations for owners, CMs, inspectors have devised thousands of contract templates that devise and articulate the way in which risk should be allocated. We should not dispense with those by carving out an exception to the economic loss doctrine as is advanced in our other cases before this court and by Mandalay in this case with any ease. We believe that the law review article that will be written about this case if we breathe life into a negligent misrepresentation exception will be titled something like The Exception That Swallowed the Rule, because it doesn't take much of a lawyer, either a plaintiff's lawyer or another defendant in a cross-claim or third-party complaint, to take a barred negligence claim and re-articulate that and reformat that into a negligent misrepresentation claim. The Terracon case itself was a case where we're dealing with some boring issues. A geotechnical engineer is claimed to be negligent in doing their geotech work. Well, the court said, no, we're not going to allow negligent-based claims. Well, if you're going to now allow negligent representation claims, it would be very easy to say, well, that Terracon company misrepresented to Mandalay that the soil condition that hotel was going to sit upon. So you just rearticulate and you open up the floodgates. We need to put a thumb in that dike, not open up the gates. I'd like to, unless there are questions, I'd like to turn the time over to my colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Mr. Edwards.
May it please the Court, Mike Edwards on behalf of Converse Consultants. I don't want to belabor the facts that Mr. Backus has made, but the trial courts in Nevada have been giving inconsistent rulings based upon the Terracon decision in the recent months. No one would suggest that the tort of negligent misrepresentation doesn't exist in the state of Nevada. It does, but it's limited. It's limited to information provided to influence somebody else in a financial transaction. That's the exception to Section 522. And I am here today on behalf of Converse and other design professionals to let you know that the courts are being loose with this interpretation. Design professionals negotiate their contracts, and as Mr. Backus said, there are risk allocations that go into those contracts, and I am asking this court on behalf of design professionals to tell the trial courts that contracts mean what they say. Contracts have to have meaning. Risk allocation procedures need to be followed, and they are not. If this court allows these offhand negligent misrepresentation claims, then what you have is a design professional who gives a design to an owner. That owner gives it to the subcontractor. That subcontractor gives it to another subcontractor. That subcontractor could give it to a material. If we allow the tort of negligent misrepresentation for designs provided after a contract has already been entered into, then we are creating a slippery slope of unlimited liability such that every single party that touches a building would be allowed to create a cause of action for negligent misrepresentation. And that's not what Section 522 of the restatement was intended to do. That's not what the Nevada Supreme Court has interpreted that section as doing. As this court has ruled in the past, negligent misrepresentation is for liability for pecuniary losses, information provided to influence somebody else to spend money or to make money or to loan money or to extend credit. The Stremel case, the Bank of Nevada case, Goodrich, all limit the tort of negligent misrepresentation to liability for pecuniary losses, information supplied in order to induce somebody to act a certain way, as opposed to design professionals. That contract and risk allocation has already been had. And with that, I will yield the remainder of my time, unless there are questions. Thank you.
In light of the 11 seconds that have been left to you, I will give you another minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, David Johnson on behalf of Tishman Construction Corporation of Nevada. It's important to draw back on the extent of the economic loss doctrine. Per Callaway, the doctrine applies to contractors and subcontractors. That's clear. Per Terracon, this court has already determined that the doctrine applies to design professionals. Well, by the same logic, and as stated in Terracon, Terracon pointed out that contractors are and subcontractors, of course, are exempted from the economic loss doctrine or covered by the economic loss doctrine. By the same token, though, the same logic should be extended to all project participants. It should be contractors, per Callaway, construction managers like my client Tishman, design professionals like Halcro, specialty consultants like RJA, inspectors like Converse Consultants. All are part of the network of contracts, the interconnected network of contracts by which the parties have allocated their risks. All parties in sophisticated parties to large commercial construction projects allocate their risk. And that was what the court had pointed out earlier. The right of the contractors, right of parties to allocate risk, may I continue?
Finish your thought.
Should be supreme. And it is suggested by the amici that the expansion or extension of the tort of negligent misrepresentation into this construction, commercial construction projects would inhibit that risk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thiel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Clark Thiel with Jones Day for respondents Mandalay Corporation and MGM Grand Resorts Development. First, I would like to address the impropriety of the request for a writ at this juncture in the proceedings. In Walters, this court said specifically that final judgment is an adequate and speedy remedy unless there are special circumstances at issue.
Do you agree with counsel's statement that this would be anticipated to be a 60-day trial?
I do not.
What's your assessment?
I think that it would probably be maybe a 15 or 20 judicial day trial.
Is it a jury trial? Is the jury demand been made?
The jury demand has been made, but there are significant issues of law. There have already been three summary judgments. One has been partially granted. The other two have been denied in their entirety. But I do believe that a number of issues would get resolved through pretrial motions and such.
So your opening remarks will address the criteria set forth in Williams and IGT, I presume.
Yes. First is whether or not the district court was obligated to dismiss the case pursuant to clear authority of statute or rule. Given that this is a writ of from a denial of a summary judgment motion, was the court obligated to dismiss the case? As this court knows, the Fifth Circuit jurisprudence in Niles Bolton is not binding on the Nevada courts. It is persuasive authority, and it was viewed as such. But the Niles Bolton decision in and of itself does not mandate the trial court's dismissal of this case. ADA obstacle preemption is not statutory. It is an exercise of policy choices. When we're looking at preemption, we're looking at three types of preemption according to the U.S. Supreme Court. It can be express, it can be implied, and if neither of the above, it can be an obstacle preemption. Nobody is arguing that this is express or implied preemption, but instead obstacle preemption. And as the Niles Bolton Court pointed out, that is an exercise of policy choices. The district court weighed those policy choices and in a 9-page order laid out the reasoning for coming down the way the court did. No statute or rule exempts Rolf Jensen from liability for its negligent misrepresentation either. Rolf Jensen raised the fact in its pleadings before this court that it is not a design professional, but it is a consultant, an unlicensed consultant that is practicing pursuant to an exception under the licensing laws. NRS 623.330 says specifically that as such, it is not exempt from any liability that might accrue. So the there's no statute in Nevada that would require the district court to dismiss the claims against Rolf Jensen. And, of course, the district court's opinion was not arbitrary or capricious. There was over an hour of oral argument. It was thoroughly briefed, and the district court issued a rather lengthy opinion or order regarding the reasoning behind the decision.
Counsel, why don't they fit under the economic loss?
I'm sorry?
Why don't they fit under the economic loss?
Is the question why don't they fit under the economic loss or under
the question,
exception
counsel?
Two?
Well, even both of them.
I would submit they don't fit under the economic loss doctrine because of the Olson analysis that excluded Chapter 40 cases from the operation of Callaway, in that there is legislation that says, and this is NRS 623.330, that non-licensed consultants such as Rolf Jensen are not absolved from any liability that might otherwise accrue. When this statute was written, the economic loss doctrine, the statute was written before Callaway, was written before Terracon, of course, and so the economic loss doctrine was not as robust and as applicable to construction cases at that time. Moving on as to why does the exception apply, because Rolf Jensen is not an architect. Rolf Jensen is not an engineer. Rolf Jensen is an advisor. Rolf Jensen provided information to Mandalay upon which Mandalay was to rely in making business decisions as to whether or not it needed to change its design, as to whether or not it needed to take additional actions to make its places of public accommodation accessible to the physically impaired. The Terracon decision looked at the architect's role in preparing plans and specifications, looked at the engineer's role in preparing plans and specifications, and said, that is very analogous to the builder that's building it. The end product is the building. I understand that. The end product provided by Rolf Jensen was not a building. It didn't contribute to the building. It was a report. It was a report upon which Mandalay was supposed to rely in making business decisions. The second point raised in IGT was whether there's an important issue of law that needs clarification and sound judicial economy and administration militates in favor of granting a petition. And in Yellow Cab, this court revisited those issues. First of all, we're not dealing with new law here that is in urgent need of clarification. The ADA was enacted over 20 years ago. What we're looking at here is we're looking at a Fifth Circuit opinion, one opinion over the last 20 years that says that it preempts state law cases of indemnity. The five cases that appellant or a petitioner has referred to don't address the preemption issue. They address whether or not there's an implied right of indemnity under the ADA. And I'll submit to you that I believe there's not an implied right of indemnity under the ADA. And this action has nothing to do with the ADA. It wasn't brought under the ADA. It wasn't brought in federal court. It has to do whether or not Rolf Jensen breached its duties to Mandalay in providing the services that it was retained to provide.
Counsel, with that belief, is there some case authority that supports your belief?
The case authority to support?
You said you believe, so I'm asking you, is there some case authority that you're putting on top of that belief?
My apologies, but which belief? I'm sorry.
You just said you believed as you went into that last sequence of thought. So I was asking for some case authority to support the basis for that belief.
That the...
as the ADA.
Yes, the ADA, for example, in the Ninth Circuit, in the Botan case, the Ninth Circuit in the Botan case used exactly the same analysis that this court used in American Federal Savings. That is, does the state law or the state action preclude compliance with the federal action? The answer there was no. That had to do with a case where a owner was seeking indemnity from a tenant. The Ninth Circuit said, even though there's a contractual agreement between the owner and the tenant, the owner isn't absolved of liability. The owner has to go do the repairs, has to do whatever it needs to do to comply with the laws.
Counsel, I think your reliance on that is suspect. That, as your opponent pointed out, that is articulated in Title III pretty explicitly. The question I think Justice Douglas is getting at, and I supplement that question, does not Niles Bolton abrogate contract indemnification claims where the ADA is being enforced here? That's exactly what it seems to say.
That is what it says. And I submit
that throw in with you that this court doesn't necessarily have to agree with the policy considerations contained in the case, and I have some reservations about that. But what would be the basis for this court rejecting the reasoning that's contained in Niles Bolton and Archstone and some of the other cases that are presented to us?
The Niles Bolton case did not delve into the purpose of the act as it is required to by the Supreme Court. When you're looking at obstacle preemption, and even the Fourth Circuit in Anderson versus Sara Lee, obstacle preemption occurs only when state law actually conflicts with federal law. We're not looking at actual conflict. So then you need to look at whether or not the purpose of the ADA is thwarted by state law or state actions. Purpose of the ADA is to eliminate discrimination against individuals. That's 42 U.S.C. section 12182. In signing it, the president, in a statement, stated that it's crafted to give the business community the flexibility to meet the requirements of the act without incurring undue cost. In the statement, the president went on to say, it's not designed to penalize those found to be in violation of its provisions, but rather to strike a careful balance between the rights of individuals with disabilities and the legitimate interests of business. The only right that a disabled plaintiff has against a place of public accommodation like Mandalay Bay is to require the removal of architectural barriers that create inaccessible areas.
So your argument is that contractual relationships in which your client seeks indemnification does not impose an obstacle to the enforcement of the ADA because your client is equally responsible with those they contract to effectuate ADA compliance.
I submit that my client is more responsible because my client is the only one that can effectuate the removal of the barriers, which is the ultimate goal of the ADA. The barriers are removed. The ADA is satisfied. Whether or not another more culpable party ends up paying for the removal of those barriers doesn't affect the ADA. And I would submit that it, in fact, encourages enforcement of the ADA. And the Department of Justice, in their regulations, said that places of business should go out and consult with people like Rolf Jensen or other accessibility providers. Because those like Rolf Jensen and the accessibility providers have the information as to how best to comply.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you, you've maintained that the court shouldn't entertain the writ because of the Fifth Circuit case and the district judge wasn't obligated to follow that ruling. Your opponents here have expressed concern about the fact that there's some language in Terracon that is creating some issues among district court judges in the application of the exception to the economic loss doctrine. Why shouldn't this court entertain the writ on that point to clarify some uncertainty associated with that jurisprudence? And assuming that we do, do you share their view that there is some uncertainty?
No, I do not. Negligent misrepresentation was not created or first recognized in Terracon. The tort of negligent misrepresentation, as set forth in the restatement, was recognized over 30 years ago in this state.
Well, this is in the context of an economic loss doctrine.
Okay. Right. Okay, so as an exception to the economic loss doctrine. Well, as the district court noted, that negligent misrepresentation can only result in economic loss. So if negligent misrepresentation were not an exception to the economic loss doctrine, there would be no tort of negligent misrepresentation. But just in the few seconds that I've left, I'd like briefly to suggest that the court look at subsection 2 of the restatement, which will address the issues raised by Amica.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thiel.
Thank you.
Ms. Weil, although you exhausted the entire 15 minutes or the entire time that was allotted to you, I will give you 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
To make a few corrections, starting inversely, talking about the economic loss doctrine very quickly, the attorneys in the respondent's brief made the argument that Rolf Jensen is a pure information provider. However, simply put, if they're only a pure information provider and their information does not end up in a tangible physical product, then why are they seeking money for retrofits having to do with various repairs that need to be made. I mean, obviously, the services that Rolf Jensen provided were in conjunction with the tangible physical product, the building, which now plaintiff seeks compensation for repairs. The lower court also found that claims against Rolf Jensen arose out of the design and construction of the project, and that Rolf Jensen rendered professional services. So simply put, I don't believe that Rolf Jensen could be somehow neither fish nor fin and be entitled to the protections of the economic loss doctrine. But turning very quickly back to the factors in Niles Bolton, plaintiff misstates one of the positions. The ADA does state that if, for clarity, individuals seeking compliance with the Act ought seek instruction from those individuals who are disabled or specific organizations that represent them. The Act does not say that they ought to consult architects or other types of consultants. It refers expressly to those individuals who have those disabilities who are best situated to discuss the options. I don't believe any one of us can say with a straight face that if an owner is faced with the option of avoiding significant fees and costs for compliance because they know that they can just hand the tab to somebody else down the road, that that is not a disincentive for compliance. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Wild. To all counsel, thank you very much for your presentations and your submissions here today. This matter will stand submitted.